Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Liz Riegel.
Hey, John.
Hey, Liz. Liz was on, you were on for the metaphysical poetry episode, and you suggested something completely different this time.
Yes. This is a book that I have much more sort of a connection and history with. I mean, I really enjoyed those poems when I read them, but this was like a book that I read over and over when I was a little kid.
And when were you a little kid? What years were that when you were reading this?
So I guess I would have been reading this in the 90s, like mid-90s-ish, which is, I guess, 5 or 10 years after it was written. And right. You said that you were a little, this like was a little bit too young for you when it came out.
Well, you know, looking over the history of this we're talking about Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game.
Oh, yeah, I guess we should have said that.
Right. Well, I think anyone who's downloaded the podcast can see what it is from the title. But the history of this is interesting. It had its genesis in a short story published in 78, and then it was written in a novel form in 85, and in its final form in 91, which is sort of the revised form where Card took into account some recent events that were happening in the world at that time with the dissolution of the Soviet bloc. So in the form that I think everyone is familiar with this book, it was written in 91, but it has been kicking around in one form or another since, I think, 78.
Yeah, and from what, just like briefly looking into this, I think that the short story was one of the first pieces of fiction that Orson Scott Card ever wrote, which I was kind of surprised to see, because despite the fact that this is definitely his most famous thing that everyone knows him from, he's had a pretty prolific career and like written a lot of really well-regarded, at least at the time, science fiction aside from that, but apparently this was kind of his first go at it, or one of them.
Yeah. No, I did read a short story that he wrote, I think, in 79. There was, back in the old days, you know, old nerds like me remember the 1980s magazine Omni, and he published in Omni in a short story called Unaccompanied Sonata.
I was going to talk about that. Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Okay, we'll bring it up because there are a lot of parallels, I think, with that short story and this novel. I read that without knowing anything about Card, and I thought it was an amazing story. But again, I was a teenager at that time. I have kicking around here some old Omni collections, and I reread it for in preparation. We can bring that up in our discussion of this novel.
Totally. So, So I myself am a pretty big nerd, and I have been reading through a bunch of old science fiction anthologies because I'm like interested to see what the genre was like decades ago. And I read a bunch of Card stories in those, including that one. And it also really made a big impression on me. And I read it having sort of forgotten a lot of the stuff about Ender's Game. And when I reread Ender's Game, I was really struck by how similar a lot of the weird themes are.
Yeah. Now this book, we were chit-chatting a little bit before the recording started, and talking about this book, reading it, you know, since I didn't read it as a teen, but my teenage kid did read it and was very struck by it. I kind of knew a lot of what happens in the story before I read it. I think it's interesting that this book has settled comfortably into young adult fiction, and it's as that it is often taught these days in high schools. But Card has claimed that he did not write this with teens in mind. which I find a little baffling. It seems to me like it's a very, very much a young adult novel, but it could be that a lot of what this book does got co-opted into young adult novels that followed after. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it seems like there's this whole genre of dystopian, authoritarian futures that in which a young protagonist has to fight against the establishment and particularly the machinations of adults who are running things.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing about this book is that he very much sort of fails to do that, which is a thing that really kind of makes this book a weird read, but I think it's one of the reasons why it's so compelling to young angry nerds, as I very much was when I read this. And I loved this book when I was a kid, and I read it over and over, although I hadn't read it, I think, since middle school when I read it for this podcast. But yeah, I think the thing that is so appealing about this to young people specifically is this guy is like horribly abused and manipulated by everyone around him, and there's really nothing he can do about it. And that is his position at the beginning of the book, and that is his position at the end of the book. And I think the main character development that he has is that he just kind of comes to accept that. But also, like, his rage at how he's being manipulated and his lack of power to do anything about it is very compelling if you're, you know, in elementary school.
Ender's Game takes place sometime in the future, in a future in which humans are going to the stars, and the titular Ender is the third child of a family, which is important because in this world, families are limited to two children unless you petition the government, as the family did. Because Ender's two older siblings were brilliant, the government allows it to happen because the government's looking out for smart kids. And Ender is a smart kid who is also ruthless at school, and he gets tapped to join the battle, what is it called, the battle school?
It's called Battle School. I was talking about this book with somebody, and I said Battle School, and they were like, that's not really what it's called, right? Like, you're just using that as a, no, it's Battle School.
Yes, there's a lot of things in here that feel like they're placeholders for name to be announced or something, but Ender goes off to Battle School, which turns out to be an orbital space station where students are put through rigorous war games that include zero gravity battles between teams that are called armies, and in their spare time they also play lots and lots of computer games, including the world's craziest adventure game that seems to be able to dig into Ender's subconscious. Ender does not make friends easily, partly because Colonel Graf, who is running this battle school, is secretly manipulating things behind the scenes to make sure that Ender is having the worst time possible, transferring him in and out of units, and encouraging Ender to develop a increasingly brutal and Machiavellian approach to the war games. It turns out that the kids are all being prepped to fight in a war against, again, named to be announced, an alien race called the Buggers, that at some time in the past clashed with Earth forces when they were trying to colonize other worlds.
I want to point out also, that's not like a revelation halfway through the book. That's like the whole setup for pretty much all the Earth politics, and like the reason that we have the battle school in the first place is like all because humanity is united in their desire to destroy this implacable enemy.
Another one of these science fiction tropes that the war-torn Earth has united in its opposition to these aliens, but simmering below the surface are all the old nationalistic impulses and resentments.
The Warsaw Pact. The evil Warsaw Pact.
Meanwhile, back on Earth, Ender's two smart older siblings, Valentine, his sister, and Peter, his evil brother, are somehow manipulating the world behind the scenes by posting articles onto the internet under assumed names of Locke and Demosthenes, because as we know, nothing gets things done on the earth better than writing op-ed pieces.
Even when I read this, which was like only a few years after it came out, I knew enough about the internet as a young child to know that this made no sense. But I think like the idea is everybody has like their citizen identifier, and there's, it's like a forum of like Greek old school democracy, et cetera, which unfortunately is not exactly what the internet is, but
right.
It was a beautiful dream.
So eventually it turns out Ender is so good at these war games, he gets promoted to the role of commander of an army of his own. He is eventually transported to yet another base for the international fleet, the IF, which is the military organization running the whole thing, where he meets, what's his name, Maser Rackham, who happened to be the hero who saved the world from the buggers the first time, and he enters into sort of a Yoda-like arrangement with him, including plenty of beatdowns daily by the old guy, who isn't as old as you might think he would be, because he's been traveling near the speed of light all these years, aging slower than the world has been aging. Eventually, Ender's old pals from battle school come out, and they start going. They go through the most intensive simulations of war games yet. And at the end of it all, Ender fights what he believes to be a simulated war to destroy the bugger's home planet, which, surprising absolutely nobody who's read a science fiction novel ever, turns out to not be a simulation. Ender was actually commanding the fleet all along, and he's destroyed the planet utterly. Dealing with the guilt of genocide, dealing with the fact that his brother Peter has apparently taken over the world in his absence, he sets off with his sister Valentine at the end of the book to join colonization of the stars, where he happens to come across a larval queen from the buggers. The buggers, it turns out, never meant to hurt humanity in the first place, and after the initial war, had no plans to attack the Earth, but they had no way of communicating with humanity. Apparently, since Ender is sensitive and somehow psychic almost, he's able to talk to the hive mind of the queen, and he sets off to find a place. The novel sets off at the end with Ender traveling to the stars to try to find a new place to recolonize with millions of little buggers.
"Come on," he said to Valentine one day. "Let's fly away and live forever." "We can't," she said. "There are miracles even relativity can't pull off, Ender. We have to go. I'm almost happy here." "So stay. I've lived too long with pain. I won't know who I am without it." So they boarded a starship and went from world to world. Wherever they stopped, he was always Andrew Wiggin, itinerant speaker for the dead. And she was always Valentine, historian errant, writing down the stories of the living, while Ender spoke the stories of the dead. And always Ender carried with him a dry white cocoon, looking for the world where the Hive Queen could awaken and thrive in peace. He looked a long time.
This book has several dozen characters in and around battle school. I have to admit, as I was reading it through, I was having a hard time keeping them all straight in my mind.
That is interesting because, I mean, despite the fact that I would not have remembered probably any of their names except for Petra, and that's just because she's the only girl, when I reread this, I remembered them all immediately and, like, what their sort of roles were. But they all have sort of, like, they have a function in the story more than being their own characters, mostly, I would say. So I didn't have trouble keeping them separate, but that's not, like, a great reason for that.
There are characters who show up, but they tend to be there to provide a certain amount of color. In some ways, this story reminded me of, if you ever read science fiction from the so-called Golden Age, from the 30s and 40s, there was this trope of characters appearing who are just, who their personality is their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. There's just, you know, that shows up later in Star Trek, in that you have Chekhov, whose main role is to be Russian, and you have Scotty, whose main role is to be Scottish. There was this way in which all the characters have an ethnicity as their personality. And one of the things that's disturbing about this to me is not, first of all, that, but secondly, Petra, as you mentioned, her ethnicity is she's the girl.
Yes. The only girl, because as the narrative explicitly states, evolution means that girls mostly can't do good in battle school, which bothered me even at the time. You know, I'm going to say a lot of critical things about this book. I want to make it clear. I loved this book when I was a kid, and I still really enjoyed rereading it. Yeah. It's just that there's a lot of weird stuff in it that never, like, occurred to me when I was reading it as a little kid.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the themes here, because I do think you mentioned early on the major theme of this book in some ways is abuse. It's Ender comes from a background where his parents don't love him because they have put all of their hopes in their two older official children.
Well, and they're horribly conflicted because having a third child is like this awful thing in the society they live in, except they're both from fringe religions that think that having more children is a good thing, except that they're trying to blend in, so they were totally only again ever going to have two children. It's like this whole really convoluted.
And I never quite understood this world in which there's a strict regimen of population control by the world government. We've been told that in the war with the buggers, there were just large swaths of the population were destroyed in that war. So I don't know what's going on. I guess maybe people are you know, they have kids, and so.
Yeah, well, this is also, like, not quite 100 years later, but it's many, many years later. And I think there's a thing that I think is, like, mentioned vaguely a couple of times where they don't really, they haven't made attempts to colonize other planets, and I think a large part of that is because of this, like, terrifying threat of these aliens who murder people.
So in addition to the lack of love from Ender's parents, the fact that Peter is an actual psychopath
whose skins squirrels alive and watches them die, I cannot overstate.
When this book starts, Ender is 6, Valentine is 8, and Peter's 10. And we're told that they have these, that Peter is a full-blown psychotic at the age of 10, who threatens Ender's life in the second chapter of the book. So not only are his parents lacking in love, his older brother wants to kill him. Valentine is the only bright spot in young Ender's life, but he's whisked away from her very quickly.
Yes, and she sort of becomes this, like, symbol of all that is right and good and worth fighting for, et cetera, and humanity.
No, that's important to point out there what you say about symbols, because a lot of what people do in this book doesn't make a lot of sense from a standpoint of individual motivation or the psychology or personality, but it makes a great deal of sense from the standpoint of an author developing themes. In this world, we have Peter as being a masterful person because he is able to exploit people's anxieties and fears, and that's supposedly why he's such a effective writer. Whereas Valentine is supposed to be someone who is unconditionally loving, and that's her superpower,
which she also delights in using to manipulate people as the book goes along.
But Ender's superpower is he is uncommonly empathetic. He is able to understand how people think by observing them and really get into their heads, and that gives him, according to this book, the advantage when it comes to anything to do with conflict, because he can see exactly what his enemy is about to do.
Yes, much like Will Graham from Hannibal.
And once he makes it to battle school, he's getting it from all sides. He's getting it from rival students who don't like the fact that he's such a star. He's getting it from Colonel Graf and who's the second in command there?
Anderson? That guy did not matter except to be the other guy in the conversations with Colonel Graf, though.
They use this device throughout the book of having each chapter introduced with a dialogue between Graf and someone else, usually Anderson, but we don't know who they are at first, and then eventually we get to know who they are. These voices become the voices that give all the exposition dumps at the beginning of chapters.
Yes.
So there's a lot of very, I don't know what I would call very science fiction-y writing in this story. You know, I grew up reading a lot of old science fiction. As I got older, I realized that a lot of the writing wasn't that great. This book reminded me a lot of what I would consider the kind of science fiction that came out in the 60s and 70s that I associate strongly with Ray Bradbury, or later with someone like Harlan Ellison, which is, it's the science fiction of ideas. It's mm-hmm. like these broad themes are laid out, and they're trying to be dealt with in a way that makes poetic truth, and there's not a lot of concern given to the actual mechanics of what's happening. You know, quite often, sometimes the science part of it is extremely dodgy or ridiculous, or they just hand wave it away. You know, one of the things that's important in this book is the development of faster than light communications, that which would, when you think about it, would be the only way you could direct a battle from a remote location and get feedback on what's happening in real time. They actually say in the book, "Oh, I can't explain it to you. Nobody understands it."
Well, he's like, most people don't understand it, and I'm not a scientist. I think that stuff actually didn't bother me that much on reread. I guess just because I read a lot of science fiction, it's probably my favorite genre to read, and a lot of this stuff I just sort of accept as like, oh, this is a convention of the genre, not like this is lazy sci-fi writing, that just this is a thing that they do.
It's sort of like the idea of faster than light travel to begin with. If you don't posit that's possible in some way, that kind of puts a screeching halt on everything. You know, that's one of those depressing things that you realize when you actually learn about physics in the world, and you learn that there are these limitations on speed. Then you suddenly realize that you aren't going to the stars anytime soon with the universe we live in.
I mean, faster than light travel is not possible in these books, as far as I can tell. But faster than light communication is, for hand-wavy reasons that never matter.
You talk about how, as a kid, you realized that some of the things were wrong about this book. I think it's interesting looking at it as a book written in 91, partly because all the games that Enders plays at battle school tend to be some variant of adventure games, which was what was the current vogue in computer games at the time. That was all you could do pretty much in the early 90s. You know, there were arcade style games, but they were very sprite based and very simplistic. Even what Doom came out in like what, 93, 94, something like that. So it's funny to think that as Card was writing this, his model for what a state-of-the-art computer game would be something like The Secret of Monkey Island.
I read a story of his that a lot, it all had to do basically with cracking somebody's password, and I thought it was incredibly good, except for his idea of what the password security of the future would be was like hilariously optimistic / naive.
No, that's funny. There's a lot of points in this book where technology is highlighted in the way that people like to highlight technology in science fiction stories. And some of the things that they posit are a sort of a text messaging system that they all use, which for some reason they describe as flashing around people's desks. Like, that's what you want. That's what everyone wants, is you want your text messages to flash in big letters where everyone can see them. And the way that you defeat this text message system to make it to spoof someone else's username is you simply append a space to the end of their username.
Yes. You know, that all seemed totally brilliant to me when I was like in sixth grade and reading this, I must say. But it was also the mid-90s. I do want to say about that computer game. So, okay, they play a lot of sort of strategy, like fighting games. And then there's this game that they all have on their little equivalent of iPods that they all carry around. That's like this fantasy exploration. I can't remember what it's called, but I think it's just called Free Play, right?
Something like that.
It's this massive, like procedurally generated wonderland where you like approach a thing and you go through it, and it's sort of like the game itself develops along with what you're doing. And I think it is implied later on that this is sort of how the Bugger Queen wound up being able to get inside Ender's head, by somehow interfacing with this game or like understanding what he did through the game. They get into this a little bit more actually in the sequels to this book, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But I still think, I thought at the time, and like on rereading, I think there's a lot of like genuinely really cool and beautiful images in this game, in this like surreal game that Ender plays, that like psychoanalyzes him basically as he plays it. He's like, you know, there's this thing where he faces this giant who gives him two drinks to drink, and no matter which one he chooses, he'll always die in some novel, horrible way. And then he kills the giant by tunneling through its eye and like pulling out chunks of eye goo like cottage cheese, as it very vividly says. And then like the body slowly decomposes and turns into a house for like little gnome guys. And it all is just very cool to read and to think about this character wandering around in this surreal dreamscape. I don't know how you felt about that, but I thought it was still pretty effective.
Oh, I thought that was great, actually. I mean, it makes no sense from a programming standpoint, but there's two ways you could go with this. You could either really try to delve down into what it means for something to be procedurally generated by getting feedback from your thoughts and how on earth you would even implement something like that. That's not what Card's interested in. Card's interested in creating a sort of a dreamlike state. And I think that to the extent that this book engages in those dreamlike states, I find those passages to be beautiful and successful. To the extent that Card wants to make some sort of a positive statement about psychology or about politics as they are in the world, I feel like he loses everything. I feel like I don't believe him for a minute, and I start to doubt everything he's saying. I mean, we talked briefly about this whole subplot with Peter and Valentine. And that Peter basically announces that, oh, he sees that once the Bugger War is over, there's going to be war on Earth. And he says, now is the time to influence the world. And then we're given absolutely nothing as to what he's supposedly writing online that is swaying opinion. As far as I know, there's no actual politics put forth. We're just told that he's so persuasive as Locke, and that Valentine on a lark joins him and writes under the name Demosthenes, and somehow they are making millions of dollars and taking over the world, and there's no explanation of that at all.
You know, I kind of want to say I appreciate the degree to which, like, if you're going to write a character who's smarter than you are, which these guys have to be because they're basically some of the smartest people in the entire world, is the fiction. I kind of appreciate that he was like, you know what? I can't fake that. So I'm just going to talk about what the effect of it is, rather than trying to put myself in the position of the smartest person on earth. I mean, it still doesn't quite work, but that's why it doesn't bother me so much.
Yeah, this is a thing I always have a problem with, is whenever a character is supposed to be, whenever we're told a character is supposed to be particularly smart or particularly funny or particularly seductive or particularly has any of these traits that are unusual and give them a strong advantage in the world, I feel like it's incumbent on the author to convince us of that fact. And I remained so thoroughly unconvinced. At least with Ender, we're taken through the fact that he, when we see his strategizing, we're told two things. One is he is not afraid to break the spirit of a game if it means winning on a technicality. He will always go for the technicality if he can see an easy victory. And secondly, we're told that he will be particularly brutal in putting down an enemy to try to convince them never to attack him again.
Yes, this is one of the very first things we learn about Ender when he is a six-year-old boy who is being bullied and decides that he must totally destroy the guy who just attacked him, or else they'll come after him again. And we later learn that he killed that boy, which is insane.
I'm sorry to laugh. That's a terrible thing to laugh at.
Oh, no. I mean, well, this is really like... So I feel like we're jumping around a lot, but there's a lot of stuff going on in this book, I think. But this is like a thing. Ender twice kills someone in hand-to-hand combat without realizing he's done it. And then, of course, at the end of the book, he kills an entire civilization without realizing he's done it. Which is... Okay, so, like, here's the thing. There's zero real sense of disagreement, like, on the part of any characters or, like, the narrative voice or anything, that the monstrous thing that Ender did wasn't necessary. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, it's treated as, like, this sort of monstrous but necessary abuse of this little boy to get him to the point where he's, like, able to commit genocide, basically. But there's also sort of not much sense that that genocide wasn't totally necessary.
You know, I know what you're getting at. It's a hard thing to put into words. The end of this book, where we are invited to see things from the bugger's perspective, when we are invited to see how heavily the guilt weighs on Ender, we as readers are supposed to see the destruction of the buggers in their home planet as monstrous. We as readers are supposed to see the treatment of Ender as monstrous, but there is no clear voice going through the narrative of the book up to that point that serves as a counterbalance to Graf's highly Machiavellian, we've got to do this because we just have to save the world at all costs.
Right. Well, and he's also repeatedly shown in private conversations where Ender's either not there or passed out and isn't sure that he really can hear him, talking about how much he regrets, how much he has to hurt this boy to get him to do this stuff, which is a total cheat, I feel like. And they also use the character of Valentine, whose, like, whole purpose in the narrative is to be the, you know, sweet, caring, empathetic one. And she repeatedly also makes the argument that this is necessary and Ender has to do these things. And it's really bizarre because I think the fact that that is the case is interesting, but the narrative doesn't treat it as if it's interesting. It treats it as if it's sort of makes perfect sense. But to me, it doesn't.
When I was reading a little bit on the background of this, and I didn't do a lot of research. I just read a few articles online. I found out that this book has been praised by people in the military as providing what they see as a philosophical reflection on the methods and justification for war. I feel like Card wants to end his book on a note of uplift, but it's so dark and miserable all the way through. I feel like people can look at this kind of like a Rorschach test and decide that they can decide whatever they want from this book. For people who have that romantic view of the idea of being a warrior is an act of self-sacrifice, and those people who protect freedoms do it at great cost to themselves, and that's somehow a noble thing. I think you could justify that for this book if you wanted to. But I also feel like you could justify exactly the opposite thing.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, actually. Like, it's not when you start to try to figure out which ones of those is true, then you start, like, looking at other stuff Card has read and, like, trying to psychoanalyze the author of this book, which is not really a fair way of... I mean, it's like, an interesting thought experiment, I guess, but, like, as a book, it can be taken either way, I would definitely say.
Well, I would also like to, at this moment, invoke the Stuart Wellington purge analogy, which is people create a fictional world that's horrible, and then they say, oh, what a horrible world this is. Wouldn't it be horrible if this were the case? And it's like, but you made that world. That isn't anything. Again, this is a world that in which people put up with kids being taken off and isolated and trained as soldiers and physically and mentally abused and then put on the line. As I say this, two things occur to me, which is one, we are currently dealing with the forced separation of children from their parents at the border in this country. And two, we have also had the announcement today that there needs to be a space force to protect American interests. So maybe
the existence of Battle School itself, like, seems at all, like, incorrect to me. Or even the crazy way that they run it, where they're, like, pitting small children against each other in these, like, Machiavellian games. Like, that all seems like totally something the military would do. No shade.
We were talking also before we started the podcast about the short story Unaccompanied Sonata.
Yes.
Do you want to bring that up here and talk about that a little bit?
Yes, definitely. As I said, I've been reading back sort of systematically through old sci-fi anthologies and trying to write down what I think of them all, because I'm, like, trying to learn more about people who, like, mostly just wrote short stories and not novels. But so this one really stood out to me the first time I read it, and then when I went back and read it also, because this is a story that presents a sort of morality that both didn't really resonate with me or make sense to me on, like, my own personal moral level, but also seemed, like, very deeply felt within the story and, like, very effectively shown and, like, demonstrated within the story. And that stuck with me because I was like, I don't quite know if that's how the author intended me to feel or if the author's mind just works in a totally different way from mine. And I think upon rereading Ender's Game, it might be more the latter. But do you want to talk about what happens in this story, or do you want me to try and...
You can give a little rundown, but I'll just say this was a story that appeared in Omni magazine back in, like, 1978 or 1979. I actually read this in Omni magazine because that was what you did when you were a little nerd back in the late 70s and 80s, when you got your hands on Omni magazine, which seemed like a forbidden magazine at the time. I don't know if you're familiar with Omni magazine, but it was published by Bob Guccione Jr., who published Penthouse. It was supposed to be a magazine of science and science fiction, but it was also wrapped up with pictures of sexy robots and strange paranormal stories about UFOs and cryptozoology. That was the way we rolled back in the 70s and 80s. Anyway, so into this weird soup appeared this short story, Unaccompanied Sonata, by Orson Scott Card, which again must have been one of the very first things he wrote.
Okay, so the world is essentially a utopia, and part of the reason for that is because the, not exactly government, the sort of, like, governing whatever society puts you exactly where you ought to be, like, knows exactly what kind of life and job you should have and puts you there and has you do that. And for the few people who have incredible artistic gifts, this means that you are put into total isolation from the time you're a pretty young child, and you are sort of given free rein to discover your own creativity, but you were forbidden from being exposed to any other forms of the art form that you are a genius in, which already rings a lot of bells with Ender's Game. This is all just the very setup of this story. This boy is a genius musician. He's put in this cabin in the woods with this incredible instrument that can make any sound at all. He's composing this incredible music that's entirely unique. And then one day, some people, who I can't really remember the details of, come and give him some forbidden music. He listens to it. Despite his best efforts, it shows up in his music, and the Watchers, I guess they're called, discover that he has been exposed to this music, and I believe they forbid him from ever making music again, send him off to some other assignment. Long story short, a bunch of times he can't resist breaking the prohibition to make music. Each time, subsequent to the first time, he is mutilated in some way. I believe he loses his fingers, eyes, and tongue, although I might be wrong about one of those. And at the end of the story, he becomes a watcher who is in charge of enforcing this prohibition over other people. And you get inside his mental state, this character, a little bit, but really it's just sort of the straightforward presentation of these are the events that happen. And there was nothing in the story, either within or without the character, that implied that this didn't all make sense, like this, that the Watchers weren't correct. But I wasn't sure, and I'm still not sure, honestly, whether we are meant to believe that they are correct or not, or whether it's meant to be ambiguous.
This story is interesting for a lot of reasons. I think that when I read it through, it caused me mostly to wrestle with this idea that somehow art is best that comes completely devoid of influence, which now that I'm an older person, I've had a lot of theory behind all this. I recognize as a highly modernist, highly constructivist view of art, the idea that art has integrity that belongs only to itself, devoid of all context, which I think is an absurd one now that I'm older. I think that art obviously only exists in context and in tradition, and so I would have problems with that. But reading it through again before I read this book, before I read Ender's Game, it made me think Card is, in these two stories, and I don't know the rest of his literature, it may be in other stories as well, he seems obsessed with this idea of a highly controlling society that is going to try to prescribe for everyone the roles that they're supposed to play, and the idea that individuals suffer because of this societal impulse to cause people to conform, but that conformity isn't necessarily at like a Brave New World style conformity or a 1984 style conformity where people are being broken simply to make them useful tools of the state. It's the conformity of the belief of the state. The state knows what's best for its citizens. Putting these two stories together, I get this picture of Card as the kind of person who believes that we live in a culture where the danger is well-meaning people trying to prescribe for people what they're supposed to do. We have to talk, I guess, about Card's political controversies.
Yes. So a couple things. First, I would like to say, I was actually very familiar with Orson Scott Card's political writing because I am from Greensboro, North Carolina, which is the Earth location in these books where Ender's family lives, and it's also where Orson Scott Card lives. And Orson Scott Card wrote for our local conservative weekly newspaper. He had several columns, which were, back when I was reading them in the 90s and early 2000s, relatively moderate. From what I understand, he has gotten much more sort of reactionary in recent years, but at the time, he was sort of like in an opposing perspective that I often disagreed with, but also valued. And it like really bums me out to see that nowadays he's mostly known for being super homophobic. But if I may read you a thing from his Wikipedia page, which is very relevant to the thing that you just said. Describing himself as a political liberal and moral conservative, Card's ideas concerning society are described as communitarian. In 2000, Card said, "Most of the program of both the left and the right is so unbelievably stupid it's hard to wish to identify myself with either, but on economic matters, I'm a committed communitarian. I regard the Soviet Union as simply state monopoly capitalism. Real communism has never been tried. I would like to see government controls expanded, laws that allow capitalism to not reward the most rapacious exploitive behavior. I believe government has a strong role to protect us from capitalism." Which is really not what you would expect a guy to say based on only the sort of controversy that came up after the movie came out, which I think is when a lot of people were first exposed to his politics. Like, I think there were a lot of people who read this book as a kid, never really thought about it again. And then when the movie came out, there were a lot of think pieces written about his beliefs. And then a lot of people I knew, it was like the first time they found out about it. But yeah, based on that quote, it really sort of seems like he's pro that stuff that you were saying.
The other thing to say about Card is he's Mormon.
Yes, of course. That's very important.
He comes from a tradition that does put a lot of value on the community upholding standards and on there being some idea of a commonality of space, a commonality of ownership among certain things. Quite often in this country, we tend to think of things as being on the spectrum of left and right, when actually there's a lot of these ideas that get lumped together just out of the mistakes of history and the way that things turned out in this country. Certainly, Card has been vocal in his opposition to gay marriage. But he also, interestingly enough, came out after the Supreme Court decision, which stated because of the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution that gay marriage in one state effectively means gay marriage is the law of the land in all states. He basically said, it's done. It's over now. It's been decided legally. It's an interesting thing to come out and say, to basically say, well, now that there's been a legal decision, we just live with it. You know, that's a kind of a strange point of view to take whatever side you come down on an issue.
Sort of. I mean, I think there's times when I or other people would sort of concede a thing like, oh, well, we're passionate about this, but we got less and less so as it went on and it became clear that it wasn't as big of a, but like, I don't think he's taken his sort of, he hasn't come around and said, oh, I think it's totally fine. And I doubt that he ever will. But I know that he has expressed frustration himself because a lot of people on the right, or like in his church, think that he's too liberal on a lot of issues. And I think it's just that the beliefs that he does have that are on the conservative side of the spectrum are so much more unacceptable to the left that, like, it's kind of a non-starter.
When we were talking earlier about the way that certain passages of Ender's Game are more dreamlike and poetic, the thing I liked about Unaccompanied Sonata is it's completely dreamlike and it's in both what the depiction, what it depicts in the way it's written, its themes. One of the reasons it's so hard to even say what that story is about is it's confusing. It's vague.
Yeah.
It follows its own logic. And to the extent that Card does that in his writing, I'm along for the ride simply because it's such a weird and idiosyncratic point of view. And I don't think about it in terms of whether or not I agree with it politically or not. I feel like I'm being treated to someone's strange subconscious obsessions.
Yeah, I would recommend that anybody listening to this go find that story and read it. It's really cool. And it will give you some stuff to think about and possibly a new perspective on this strange man who wrote it.
Yeah, no. And it will probably make you cry if you're like me.
I mean, definitely it's worth pointing out, like, the specific theme of isolation leads to creativity is explicitly stated several times in Ender's Game by the people who were manipulating Ender. And it's, that's like really interesting that that very specific thing comes up in both of these works.
In both these works too, as readers, I think, you know, we can't help but question whether that's actually true. You know, we're presented with one case in these, and we don't get the counterfactual. We don't get to see Ender match wits with somebody who came through a training with, you know, surrounded by friends, with the full support of his loving family or whatever. And similarly, in an unaccompanied sonata, we don't get to see what, you know, the alternative of this, which is the artist who works in a strong tradition alongside colleagues, bouncing ideas off of people, quoting passages from other people's works, whatever.
Do you think, because I honestly, like, having like thought about this in preparation for this podcast, like, I still couldn't say for sure, you know, what I'm supposed to get out of either of these stories, like, sort of morally speaking.
I feel like Unaccompanied Sonata works better because it is completely ambiguous and is completely left up to you're left as a reader to try to make sense of this very strange story. I think Ender's Game, too often in through the course of the book, Ender's Game has characters making positive statements about the way the world is.
Yes.
And we are invited, I think, at the end of the book to see Ender's quest to save the bugger species as a redemptive one and a noble one. And so we are left at the end of that book to try to sort out good and evil in a way that not that the rest of the book may not actually support.
Yeah, it's, you know, we spend most of the time in this book inside of Ender's head for like brief breaks out of it to hear other people's conversations. And I think that might be part of the what we're talking about here, like the reason for it is because there is no like author's statement or like external to the character statement about which of these things is actually true. It just sort of shows what they felt about what they went through.
You know, that I want to go just a little bit extra textual for a minute here, because I also watched the movie in preparation for this podcast. And one of the things that struck me strongly about the movie was, first of all, they got rid of all the nuttiness with Peter and Valentine. But secondly, the end of this book, which it basically takes place once Ender has left Earth for good and gone off to eventually fight this battle that will destroy the bugger homeworld, is very long and very protracted in the movie. In the book, it takes place in about, I don't know, 10 to 20 pages of what's like a 300-page book. It's very brief. And then there's a protracted epilogue about what happens on Earth and what goes on with Ender and Valentine afterwards.
Yeah, I was reading this on a Kindle and I was really surprised because he destroys the bugger homeworld at like 85% of the way through it. And then there's still like a ton of stuff left that happens.
But the actual sequence of arriving at what's it called? Eros, where they're stationed, this planetoid that they're stationed on, they're directing the attack on the bugger homeworld. That only takes place in a couple, like about 10 pages or so. Like all the characters show up from battle school. They just like pop up again and they're like, great, let's go do it. And they do it. And then we get a whole epilogue after that. In the movie, that sequence goes on and on and on. I mean, maybe it's because they want to spend a lot of time on special effects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the other thing I have to say about the book is sometimes it's hard to actually visualize some of the things that are happening. There's a lot of descriptions of the battle games inside the arena, at Battle School, and I'm never quite clear as I'm reading that how that's supposed to translate into actual tactical maneuvers in space.
Oh yeah, I like honestly, I think because I read this book so many times when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time figuring out like exactly what physically was going on in those scenes. And so when I was rereading it, it just like all made perfect sense. That's another thing in this book that is really fun and cool, I thought, is the battle room things where they're basically like fighting war games in zero G with like laser guns and big obstacles and like lack of space. It's like, I don't know. I would love to go play around a battle room.
There are a few passages in this book where Card describes Ender being involved in hand-to-hand combat. You know, we talked about these two scenes where he accidentally kills his assailants. And I am by no means an expert, but I have taken enough jiu-jitsu classes in my time to think that the Card doesn't really know what actual physical combat entails. And when I was reading the battle sequences in the arena, all I could think of was going and playing laser tag.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever played laser tag, you realize it quickly devolves into people running around and screaming and kids just like jumping up behind you and shooting you as many times as they can. And you can think you're going to approach this with some degree of sophistication and strategy and command of the battlefield. And I feel like it would all fall apart almost immediately.
Yeah, there's some stuff in here. Repeatedly, Ender is the first person to come up with something that isn't like exactly screamingly obvious, but you'd really think that one of these other super geniuses who plays this game all day would have figured it out by now.
Yeah, there's a lot of these things that are like, there's a point where Ender talks about approaching the enemy feet first because it provides a smaller target for their guns. And I feel like that would be like the first thing anyone would figure out. I don't want to be too down on this book because I do think that I do see how if I read this book as a kid, it would have been highly formative. I think that, for example, the big reveal at the end that Ender was actually destroying the Bugger homeworld when he thought he was running an advanced simulation, Well, I felt like that was telegraphed a long ways off. I could imagine being broadsided by that as a kid. And it is an interesting question because the question then becomes, would you have fought differently if you thought the stakes were real? And then the question becomes, is it better to approach war with a completely cold and calculating abstract mind that treats it just like a game of chess in which every piece is expendable? Or is it better to wage war with some sense of morality and ethics?
I mean, the idea that I think is presented of Ender in this book is that he straddles that line effectively, and that's the reason that they felt they couldn't tell him, because they needed somebody who would be theoretically ruthless but who isn't the sort of person who would ever go so far as to commit genocide. So they trick him into committing genocide, which is like totally, I mean, like within the fiction of the story is totally cowardly on the part of the adults in this book. Like they refuse to take responsibility for making that decision themselves, and they make an 11-year-old boy do it and then let him become the greatest monster in human history, which can I drop a couple notes about the next book in this series, which I have not read.
Oh yeah, sure. Please.
So I actually think it is superior as a piece of science fiction, although that is my opinion based as a middle schooler. But Ender is still alive, but has been traveling, and so in like at relativistic speed, so it's like 1,000 years later, and he is considered to be like history's greatest monster, based on the book that he himself writes at the end of this book, showing the Hive Queen's perspective, and I kind of he basically seems to think that about himself as well. Like at the end of this book, he sort of like accepts that this was such a horrible thing to do, despite the fact that he didn't know what he was doing. He takes responsibility for it anyway.
Well, there were other books too. Did you read how many books in the series were there eventually?
Okay, let me I think there are like 7 or 8 other books. There's two different paths that they take. There's 3, I think, direct sequels to this book. And then there's a spin-off that is from the perspective of the character Bean, who's one of the kids in Battle School, and then it follows like Bean and also Petra and Peter and the people who stayed on Earth basically and didn't, like, Ender and Valentine go off and have adventures in the cosmos for the next several books. But so I read Ender's Shadow, which is the first one with Bean, and I didn't like it enough to continue with those. But I read all the spin-offs, or the like direct sequels to Ender's Game. The next one is called Speaker for the Dead. It has some very strange and interesting sci-fi concepts in it to do with like evolution and viruses and what all. And I thought it was really cool. I'm actually going to read it again next after this, I think, and just I'll be interested to see if I still think it's super cool. But yeah, it's in the subsequent books, humanity as a whole kind of takes it for granted that Ender is right in his own analysis of himself at the end of this book, which is that he committed genocide and is sort of monstrous for having done so. I wonder if that changes anything about how you view this book.
I'll say that I felt like there were hooks in this book that were put in place to make sequels possible. I felt like there were a lot of the business at the end of this book was simply setting things up to have the ability to write another book afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
As a standalone book, I feel like the whole twist of Ender thinking he was playing a game that turned out to be a real battle, that is so much presented as a big reveal that works better in concept as a short story than it does as a novel. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a small idea in a way, and it's an idea that's not a bad idea for a story, but it's an idea that can be expressed in a story. And I think that's what Card did. And then he enlarged the story with a lot of characters and a lot of other ideas that diluted it thematically. Now, I mean, I don't know what you want out of me. I read this book when I was 50 years old. I did not read this book when I was 15. Or I think probably more like 10 or 12 would have probably been the absolute best age to read this book. But I mean, I feel like there's a lot of sloppiness in this book, and there's a lot of people being written in ways that I don't think people actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I did not buy Peter or Valentine at all as characters, and I couldn't bring myself to care about what they were doing, and it made me very distressed that became a major plot point at the end of the book. But, as you say, there are passages in here that I really did like. I did like the basic idea of Ender as a character, and I did have that strong feeling of it's a great trope for a young adult book to have the young character who's being manipulated by grown-ups, whether it be because they're duplicitous or because they feel like they know what's best for him or they know what's best for the world. I think that's the basic conflict of every generation as it takes its place in the world, is the fact that the previous generation thinks that they have things set up for everyone's good.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger generation can see where there's injustice and the older generation isn't buying it. That's a very basic conflict in the world. And I think I found that all to be quite engaging.
Yeah, when you put it like that, it's kind of like Harry Potter-esque in a way, like And this was about the same time, I would say, that I was reading the first Harry Potter books and reading this. And I'm sure I got similar things out of them in that way.
Well, any last words?
One or two, I think so. I was trying to decide as I was reading this again if I would give it to a kid these days. And I'm not 100% sure that I would, because it's so, like, the messages of it are so, like, odd, and some of the interpretations of those messages are so, like, at odds with what I believe about the universe, I guess. But I think I would recommend reading it, like, maybe not as an adult, but as a teenager, like, with an awareness of this is a very idiosyncratic book, like, from a philosophical standpoint. Like, but give it a look, because there's some interesting stuff in there. So, a very convoluted recommendation.
Thanks to co-host Liz Regal. Also, thanks to reader Jason Snell. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. You can visit theincomparable.com, write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, join us in the Facebook group, or look for us in the Incomparable membership Slack. Those are all great things to do, but mostly keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.